Depending on who you talk to, the minerals lying beneath Brady Glacier in Glacier Bay National Park will either make the owners wealthy or act as a mineral albatross for anyone holding the claim. When owners originally struck the patent some 70 years ago, Brady Glacier lay outside the park. Even so, the claim's isolation from ports, roads, or rail made development difficult at best, and so it's lain fallow for over half a century. But university geologist Paul Metz insists Brady Glacier promises great things.
The estimated tonnage for Brady Glacier is about 100 million tons. The gross metal value at today's prices of that 100 million tons would be about $5.7 billion.
But Met acknowledges digging in national wildlife parks is problematical. Still, there are provisions to allow it, and the decision to dig or not, he says, is political, not engineering. He points to a roughly comparable Canadian project recently purchased by a large mineral company for billions of dollars. He says if the university simply retained a 4% royalty fee, the school could make millions of dollars from Brady Glacier. Since the current consortium of owners are looking to sell the claim at a rock-bottom price, roughly about $100,000, the deal attracts university regent Joe Henry. He looks to bolster the school's sagging finances, even if the idea of digging in a national park riles some conservationists.
The owners who patented the mineral claim and spent millions of dollars ascertaining the extent and the richness of the mineral have a property right there, and the government of the United States cannot willy-nilly say, well, you know, now in 1990, whenever it was, 19, whenever they made that a national park, 1980, I think, you're out. You know, that's how czars and emperors do it. That's not how a democratic government is supposed to run its affairs.
Henry says faced with poor legislative support and a small land grant, the university has to pursue any promising financial option. But what worries the Conservation Fund, a national nonprofit land trust, is not just the university's interest in the claim, but that it upset the fund's own negotiations to buy the land. The fund's Brad Micklejohn says they've been dealing with the owner since last year.
And we thought we'd arrived at a simple, effective solution that would benefit the owners and the American public. Late in 1996, we were surprised to hear that the university was intent on acquiring the property also, and we're puzzled as to the university's desire for the property. While it may be legal to mine on this Brady Glacier nickel deposit, I'd point out that this property has been through the hands of some of the largest mining companies in the world, including Newmont Mining, Union Pacific Corporation, Occidental, Anaconda Corporation, and Sea Alaska Native Corporation also held a lease on the property at one time. Almost all of these, actually all of these interests have decided over the years that the property is not economic to mine.
Micklejohn thinks the university really wants to use Brady Glacier as trading stock for other federal property to increase the school's land entitlement. But he says such land swaps are complicated, costly, and time-consuming. Micklejohn also has concern about the deal's lack of public scrutiny. The university had planned a teleconference on the purchase for today, but most of the action would have taken place behind closed doors in executive session. After Micklejohn penned a letter of concern and requested time to address the board, the university moved the meeting back. Regents will now meet in Anchorage Thursday evening, March 27th at 5:30 to discuss whether or not to buy Brady Glacier. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
I just wanted to wait until it faded out. That was awesome. Oh, it sounded good, huh? Well, that's enough. I'm going to have to already edit out.
3, 2, 1. Fish and game officials say last Thursday afternoon, two biologists were out gathering wolf data east of Denali National Park. They darted three wolves in the Yannert River Valley. The three split up, and one biologist followed one wolf into the woods. The other two ran down a trail near the Anchorage to Fairbanks intertie. By the time the first researcher returned and finished radio collaring the other two wolves, the sun was setting. So instead of airlifting the wolves off to recuperate in a less accessible area, research coordinator Ken Witten says the biologists left the wolves alongside the trail. But before the wolves recovered from their drugging, someone drove up on a snow machine, killed them, and hauled them off into the woods. Witten says his team made a judgment call that, in retrospect, was wrong.
Normally, we would capture the wolves in areas that where there wouldn't be any people or where they would not be readily accessible. There really isn't anything we can do in a case like this that can protect those wolves from trapping or hunting. Again, hunting and trapping are legal in those areas. It would be our desire, certainly in the future, to not have any more of these incidents where probably the mere fact that we were there and it just handled these wolves made them particularly vulnerable. And that's something that we try to avoid. This was an unfortunate incident. We don't want to see something like that happen again.
Biologists returned the next day to recover the carcasses and took them to Fairbanks. Meanwhile, the hunter called troopers to report the theft of what were now his wolves. Neither troopers nor Fish and Game will identify the shooter, and it's unclear whether the wolves were taken under trapping or hunting regulations. Both seasons are open. Witten says the department also notified troopers that they had the wolves and will return the pelts to the troopers. He estimates it cost the department between $500 and $1,000 to radio collar each wolf. And while they expect some will be taken in the normal course of hunting and trapping, the killing interferes with research efforts. The incident also damages the department's credibility with area residents, who say the biologist left the wolves on what amounts to a winter highway. The incident also damages the reputation of hunters and trappers. Alaska Outdoor Council Director Dick Bishop says shooting drugged wolves violates sport hunting's fair chase ethics, as well as the less rigorous standard of commercial trapping.
With regard to trapping, I think that that's really probably taking unfair advantage of the situation, even under the trapping rules and regulations.
Killing radio-collared animals is not illegal, and Bishop doesn't think it should be. But with all the money and effort that goes into Alaska's wolf management, he says hunters share responsibility for not making the situation more difficult. Researchers are looking at population dynamics in the area after the state sponsored a 2-year wolf kill aimed at helping boost the population of the Delta caribou herd. Ken Witten says since the program stopped 2 years ago, wolf numbers appear higher than before the control program. In Fairbanks, I'm John McWhorter.
Well, we were all standing out in the wind, and they had been anticipating leaders for anywhere within the last 4 hours from 9 a.m. this morning, and Boozer came through first. His team looked really good, and he was quickly followed within the hour by, in this order, Doug Swingley, Mitch Seavey, and Jeff King. And they all parked their dogs, and were looking like they were bedding down for the warmest part of the day. That's what all of them pretty much told me, 6 hours or so. But as far as conditions coming through the burn, you know, they said it was real windy. It was quite windy here in Nikolai today, but it's sunny. They said there were some punchy spots, but, you know, nothing out of the ordinary for the burn.
Should we be making much of these four being in there first?
I think these four teams are, you know, who's going to say who's going to win at this point, but these four guys are definitely in a class together. Boozer commented that he thought Jeff's dogs looked really good. His own, of course, had that look coming through when they went through Rainy yesterday. Boy, those dogs loved passing by all those teams. Of course, they had rested outside Rainy, is what Boozer told me. But his team looked really strong coming into Nikolai this morning after that long run, and he'd only had a couple of short breaks in there to snack the dogs.
How were things going through the gorge and across the burn? That can be a pretty rough section of trail.
You know, we heard more about asking the mushers that were here this morning about the burn itself. They said it was just incredibly windy out there and that the snow had drifted into places they had to punch through, and that was a little bit hard on the dogs slowing down through that. Mitch Seavey, I guess, particularly said that it knocked his dogs down to a walk during a couple of sections where there was drifted.
Where do the teams go from here, and what do you expect for the next day or so?
Well, after they rest here during the warmest part of the day, as the sun's really bright out there now, it's on to McGrath. It's about another 50 miles down the Kuskokwim. It'll probably be pretty windy, as it is windy here today. And first musher to McGrath, of course, gets a gold wash, the Golden Pace Award from AC Company. So there's always a big greeting in McGrath. There'll be tons of press there, cameras. I mean, this morning when Boozer pulled into Nikolai, there was a helicopter hovering overhead. So there's a lot of folks on the trail watching the race and sending reports to really all over the world.
Are you getting any indication of where they're going to do their 24s?
We've been trying to get that out of them, but no one's really gotten any. They just say further down the trail. Of course, they Boozer and the rest, you know, they declare their 24s when they pulled into Nikolai, but in asking them, they're all saying further down the trail, but no one's said which checkpoint they're going to give it at. Earlier, at the restart in Willow the other day, I asked Swingley, and he said he planned to move way on down the trail. He told me Grayling possibly before he took his 24. I'm not sure how much of that was just boastful or whether that'll become a reality. He is down to, I believe, 14 in his team right now. I asked him whether he thought that would make a difference. He flatly told me no, that he had 13 in Nikolai last year and still had a very fast race. So.
All right. That's Dan Bross in Nikolai. We'll catch up with you soon and look forward to another update. Thanks.
Sharp says there's a precedent for his bill. While the state's fish board doesn't require only fishers serve, he and his staff haven't found a single recent member, he says, who didn't harvest fish either commercially or recreationally. And he says his Senate Bill 22 merely does the same for the game board, so that those who pay for the service call the shots.
It guarantees that the participants in setting regulations that direct the department's management efforts will be based on some first-hand knowledge of the resource and the importance of the resource to the users all over the state.
Sharp has been a longtime critic of the game board, saying it hasn't managed the resource for hunters. But some Senate Democrats say Sharp's bill unfairly restricts women from serving on the game board. Senator Georgiana Lincoln points to the state records, which show last year only about 5% of registered hunters were women.
Because then that means that 96-97% of women in Alaska would be ineligible to serve on this board. And since 1975, six women have been appointed and confirmed to the board. In the first 10 years from 1975 to 1984, there were no women on the board at all. And I think that if we're going to be making some progress in this area, this is not the direction to go.
Other critics say Sharp's bill prohibits a healthy diversity on the board, but Sharp says having abundant game should serve the needs of tourists and outdoor enthusiasts alike.
The ultimate goal should be the same, but in a lot of instances it isn't. A lot of instances they want to keep a hands-off policy and not get involved in active management. And that, in the Arctic biology, all game managers will tell you that that provides long, deep cycles of scarcity and a long time to come back with a few hard winters and a lot of predators out there. You just don't get the prey animals back for a long, long time. That's where the conflict comes by the non-harvest users.
Sharp says predator management is a proven way to keep game populations high and healthy. He says if the House responds with the same support as the Senate, it could make the bill bulletproof. But he acknowledges lawmakers could make lots of changes to the bill before it goes to the governor. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Yeah, let it rip.
Maurice Belli still had his walking gear on with his backpack when he went to the Galena School to talk with students about what he's doing and where he's from. He started his trip from Melli, Italy, and is going to Nome like others did during the Gold Rush a century ago. It's more than just retracing history for him, though. He's been to Alaska several times before.
Yeah.
Okay. Maurice Belli still had his walking walking gear on with his backpack when he went to the Galena school to talk with students about what he's doing and where he's from. He started his trip from Melli, Italy, and is going to Nome like others did during the gold rush a century ago. It's more than just retracing history for him, though. He's been to Alaska several times before and wanted to share it with others from his country. He thought this made a good story, a story where he could capture what he sees in Alaska. He's filming his trip and plans to write a book and produce a film that will show at an Italian film festival.
For this trip, we were to produce a book and a film, but not much, not only for this trip, because I came here 8 times in Alaska, and so I will write about this wilderness country. And in this film, I explain everything about the gold rush. People come here and present my story here for explain also the story of the, about the people that live alone, or in the village along the Yukon River, you know, because there are so few people that live along the Yukon.
Billy's had some beautiful days walking across Alaska, which started early this month in Inanna. He hopes that the weather continues so he can get to Nome before everything melts. So far, he said the trip has been pretty good.
Every trip is nice for me. Every trip is nice. There are, in every place, are beautiful place, you know. Every trip is nice. Some place you are very tired, you know. Some place you can see very good sun, you know. It's very different. Every moment is different, you know. Some moments you are happy because you are not so much tired and you can see everything. Some moments you are very tired, you know. Depends. I had a good time, a good day, it's a very nice day. And so I'm very lucky, you know. I hope that the weather is the same for next day. And so I can arrive maybe without so much problem in to Nome.
Once outside, Billy took out his camera, which was reinforced with duct tape, and captured the snow-covered scene, allowing others who may never get the chance to share the beauty of Alaska. In Galena, I'm Danny Sparrow.
What happened to those two wolves?
Those two wolves were processed. They were fairly near the park's highway, and we were concerned that...
News flash for Senator Bert Sharp. Alaska's animals are not the private reserve of the 12% of Alaskans who hunt. The 88% majority of Alaskans who do not hunt have a stake in the wildlife, too. The Board of Game was not intended to manage game solely for the benefit of hunters. Read the statute. It's there in black and white. The board is to provide for the conservation and development of the state's game animals. That's why one of the board's conservation-related duties is to set apart game reserve areas, refuges, and sanctuaries. Furthermore, the board's membership is required to represent a diversity of interests and points of view. Obviously, then, the board should have among its 7 members those whose interests run along conservation lines, as well as those whose main interest is hunting. It's safe to speculate that all Alaskans cherish the wild animals, but a huge majority, 88%, do not choose to kill them. They take photographs, they hike and camp and fish and raft and climb mountains, and they think those activities are enriched when they spot wildlife. They, not just Bert Sharp's selected constituency, have a right to a voice in the management of those animals. Sharp would take away that voice with the latest of his attempts at micromanaging our fish and game. His bill would require that all the members of the Board of Game come from the 12% of us who hunt, that none may come from the 88% who don't hunt. That's special interest politicking at its naked best. It's also absurd. According to Sharp's plan, any bozo with a gun and $25 for a hunting license has more qualification to serve on the Board of Game than a professor of wildlife management if that professor doesn't hunt. For the record, I've hunted and fished for 20 years in Alaska and trapped for a few years too. Fall hunting is the absolute highlight of my year. I put my son through the Fish and Game Hunter Safety Program and have begun taking him hunting with me. It's sad that in Alaska you have to trot out these bona fides, that if you don't, you're written off as an environmental extremist. The truth is, Bert Sharp's views come from the fringe, and we should tell our legislators so before this ill-conceived and selfish little bill passes the House.
Percussionist Scott Deal teaches music at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He says performing's part of his job, just the way academics must publish. But he uses a computer and a percussion system to do his research.
This is several instruments put together. One's called a mallet cat, and it looks like a xylophone with little rubber bars. And what those bars do is they transmit signals to synthesizers, into whatever sounds you've programmed into the synthesizers, and then it plays it. And so it's called a controller.
The equipment allows Steele to perform pieces never before available to a percussionist. He uses synthesizer programs with pre-recorded sounds.
This piece is called Blow Up by David Hooser. And in the beginning, there are a lot of drum sounds. Okay, so... that kind of thing that you play. And then he has about 20, 25 sounds that he wanted me to program. So there's a metal sound, you know, and then he wanted, let's see, what's this one? He wanted a horn sound or brass sound, really, you know. And then he wanted a sort of an electrified drum sound with a wash to it, you know. And so then you put all these together and you play them. Bell sound. But then later in the piece, let's see. Okay, here. Then it's a piano. It's very gorgeous. It's this really nice piano patch. And it goes something like this. It is. It is. So these will take any sound. I mean, if you have a synthesizer, you know, whatever sounds are in it, these will play it. They just send note numbers, and then you program them to do whatever you want them to do.
By using the Mallet Cat program to co-write musical scores, Deal's changed the way music is created. Instead of performing what an isolated composer's handed over to a musician he may never meet, Deal worked directly with composer David Hooser, even though he lives in far-off Philadelphia.
What the composer will do is he'll write a piece, and he'll have the sounds in his head that he would like, and then he writes a piece based on that. But then he obviously doesn't have the equipment, and he's not going to be the one that has to also put the piece together in a performance format. He just writes it out of his head. And then I come in here, and just it's like having a plate full of different colors of paints, you know. And my palette is my mallet cat and my set of synthesizers. And I just mix and match and tweak and adjust, you know, just like, and then mix sounds just like you'd mix colors. You put sounds together and you change frequencies and you fix things and then you put it all together and hope it works together as a piece.
Deal sends his version of the work to the composer, then the negotiations begin.
What you hear in your head and what is possible to actually put out there to an audience are sometimes two different things. And he might want some event, some musical event, to happen in a certain way, but it's just not going to happen that way.
Deal says the electronic realm fascinates him because it can do things that acoustic instruments can't. It allows sounds to exist which couldn't otherwise.
During the race, I several times said I had moments where I thought, well, it would be quite fine if the race would be over now. But this morning I said, well, it's a shame that it's over now. It should go a little longer. Well, I'm enjoying it. I expected many nature beauties to see, but it was much more than I had the idea before. The race was much better, much, much better. Yeah.
Light was there, and what the wavelength characteristics were.
3, 2. Before he spoke, the governor circulated through the crowd at the Eagles Hall in Fairbanks, shaking hands with elders. Some of those who took his proffered hand returned his smile. Others looked away. But when he took to the podium to speak, the conference delegates stood in applause. Governor Knowles says while he's honor-bound to pursue the issue of Indian country to the nation's highest court, it isn't done with animosity.
I think that there is a general agreement that people should see it all the way through to its finality in the Supreme Court. And I think that there is agreement that that the appeal by whichever side would have won, just as I think Vinatai would have, the people on the Vinatai side of the case would have appealed the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals had they ruled against it. So I don't think that there is any hard feelings by any of the participants about the appeal.
Knoll says he always has opposed Indian country when it came to taxation powers and resource management. But after defending his stand, Knowles moved on to issues where he says he and Alaska Natives can find common ground. Among those issues, he listed rural sanitation, educational standards, enhanced powers for tribal councils and courts, and the governor says he plans to tackle the high energy costs villages face.
There's been a lot of discussion in years past about coal bed methane and alternative energy uses. I'm announcing today that I'm putting into the capital budget a sum total of $1 million to have a pilot project in Fort Yukon this year to drill a hole to find out, given if the geological information that we know now continues to be positive, that we will have a coal bed methane project as a pilot project for rural Alaska in Fort Yukon.
Following his remarks, about a dozen TCC delegates challenged Knowles on his Indian country policy. Shirley Dementev of Fairbanks was one of them. She says she's worked for Knowles in past elections and probably will do so again. She says while she understands his opposition to the Vinatai decision, she's really angered with the Alaska legislature.
You know, Alaska was originally all our land. It belonged to the Athabasca, to the Tlingit, to the Yupik, to the Inupiaq. They are taking money that was made from our land and using it as against us. If it was against any other group of people, there would be an outcry. But because it's against Alaska Natives, you know, doing something that they have done for untold centuries, there is no outcry. And that, to me, seems unfair.
Dementev's views were shared by many at the conference, including TCC President Will Mayo, who points to contradictory rhetoric of some politicians and organizations who say they want to give natives greater self-determination while they work to take away the tools to give tribes those powers.
For our people, subsistence has always been their culture. And when the Depression hit, people never even felt it. They didn't know there was a depression on it in the villages. I talk to the elders, you know, and they'll tell you that. And now they not only want to take away our tribal government tools for self-determination and for self-esteem and pride, but they're also wanting to take away our subsistence culture and turn it into a sport hunting, you know, haven, you know, Alaska. And it's not what it's about.
Mayo presented Governor Knowles with a woven basket at the end of the governor's speech. He told Knowles it will hold the failed challenge to Indian country, which he called a basket case. The TCC conference wraps up today. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
The ceremony centers around a stick decorated with ribbons. Agnes said it reminds her of a maypole. Along with the dancing, families give out gifts all week, ranging from snowshoes and sleds to pins and ribbons.
We start giving out the gifts that we work at for many years.
There was a time when the stick dance was almost lost. Missionaries who misunderstood the ceremony tried to end the ritual.
They thought it was all superstitious, and they tried to stop it, but they couldn't stop it. They couldn't. And we're not that superstitious to believe all, you know, what what it's all about. To me, it's just like paying back. All it means to me is paying the people back that help us in time of our grieving.
The stick dance is unique to Nulato and Caltag. The two communities take turns hosting the ceremony every other year. The week-long event ends Sunday when the stick is carried out, broken, and thrown over the bank into the river, completing the healing process. In Galena, I'm Danny Sparrow.
Get some answer.
What, and then so the next step is to find out what the processes are involved in creating this line. Is that right?
Right.
And then when do you look for something that might use it?
Well, we got funded to look at to study the optical properties of the light, the how much light is there and what wavelengths and what causes it. We're not funded to go look for phototrophs, but we kind of try to bootleg stuff like that on. I mean, no, I don't think anybody would fund us to go look for phototrophs. We know now that there's theoretically enough light to support photosynthesis, but we're right at the same order of magnitude as the minimum requirements that we know of for photosynthesis. So it's still a very iffy and very speculative kind of project that would be hard to get peers to support. So what we've done is when we go out to do these light measurements with the submersibles, when we have a chance, we grab a chunk of the sulfide. It's sort of, you know, whatever we can get, we bring up and keep it in the dark. And I've got some frozen samples. So we'll go ahead and look for phototrophs by looking for the photosynthetic pigments. We don't have the optimum samples. We just take what we can get, and we'll start looking. So I've been doing that actually for a couple of years now, just trying to accumulate some samples. I have a colleague here at UAF who's going to help me do some of the extractions and look for pigments. And then if we find something, then we can go to NSF and ask for some support to really try and nail it down what these creatures are and where they're living.
Have I missed anything?
I don't think so.
Okay. Now, let me just quickly, I think you talked about it on tape, but let me see. The kind of critters you'd be looking for are found in shallow pools sometime in kind of muddy conditions?
Yeah, there are microorganisms that photosynthesize at long wavelengths. What we know about the light at the vents is that it's predominantly long wavelength. So we're looking for a bug that would photosynthesize using light at 1,000 nanometers, say, or 900 nanometers. That's what there's most of at the vents. And that kind of organism does exist in shallow water. You can find it in intertidal mud flats and things. And while we don't expect to find the same species of bug, we know that there's chlorophylls, they're called bacterial chlorophylls, that absorb at those wavelengths. So we'd be looking for a bug kind of like that.
What you're kind of, what I guess finally, I see a whole new food web, a food chain going on in these sort of extreme and very bizarre conditions that biologists 100 years ago would in no way have predicted.
Yeah, let me, I want to make straight, the photosynthesis
is hypothetical.
It's hypothetical, and it also, even if it does exist, it's going to be energetically not very important at the vents. The chemical energy at vents would totally overwhelm any photosynthetic signal. Just the comparison of the energy levels is, there's no doubt the chemosynthesis is the ecologically important source of energy at vents. But you're right in that chemical energy, this kind of community with large invertebrates using chemosynthetic organic carbon is totally new to us. We've never imagined that would exist.
Well, thank you.
Start rolling tape right now, and if you could give me your name and title so I can set levels here.
Okay, well, my name is Alan Chave, and I'm a senior scientist at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution in Woods Hole, Massachusetts.
And when did you become aware that there was this light source, this unaccountable light source? What happened in that?
Well, I think the first sign of it was when Cindy found that, or dissected that shrimp found on the Mid-Atlantic Ridge to show that, in fact, it has a non-imaging eye. And subsequently, she made some measurements, and I heard the talks that she gave at the American Geophysical Union meeting in probably 1990 or thereabouts, but I don't remember the exact date. And then subsequently, she had a workshop, was the convener of a workshop here in Woods Hole in early 93. That's really when I got involved, is after that workshop. So I've been aware of this for some time, but
right.
I haven't been involved in it until more recently.
And what we're looking at is that at certain wavelengths, there is a great deal more light being generated than just a warm body would indicate, because I know that there's warm body radiation, and it seems like at certain wavelengths, there's a lot more going on there. Is that right?
That's correct. There's one particular wavelength that we're seeing 19 times more light than we would expect to see if it were simply thermal radiation.
What does that tell you?
Well, it tells us that the source of the light cannot be purely thermal radiation. If it were purely thermal radiation, then you wouldn't see that excess of light. And so there has to be something, some additional source of light superimposed on a thermal radiation background. There are a number of possible mechanisms, and at this point we can't say which one is the right one.
Can you go over sort of the likeliest list of candidates? What are some of the top suspects for this?
Well, there's chemiluminescence, which would be light emitted due to chemical reactions, and there are, of course, many kinds of reactions happening when this hot water comes out of a vent. There's triboluminescence caused by crystal fracture, crystalloluminescence, and sonoluminescence, and those are probably the foremost likely ones. There are some others that are a little further down the list.
Mm-hmm. Now, your task now will be to look and find out which of those. If you get more data, a certain kind of data, that'll pair off or narrow the likely suspect, so to speak?
Yes, if we can get better information about what the spectral content of the light is, and also information about where the light is coming from, whether that light is, for example, is coming from the very throat of the vent where there's lots of hot water, or further up where there's more chemical reaction going on as the hot water hits cold water and you get the black smoke precipitating out. And to do that, we're building a camera system that actually collects images in specific spectral bands at the same time. In fact, 9 spectral bands at the same time. And that should go to sea at the end of next year.
And what kind of instruments do you need to make those kind of tests? You have to design a new kind of instrument, or what are you looking at there?
We're designing optics to go on a very high-quality charge-coupled device or CCD camera that is built for example, for low-light astronomy applications. And in fact, we have an astronomer collaborating on this, a man named Tony Tyson from Bell Laboratories in New Jersey.
And is it trickier using something like this down at those depths and near those temperatures, events?
Well, the camera never sees anything except for the ambient temperature, which is about 2 degrees centigrade, almost freezing temperature. It's trickier in the sense that you have to put everything in a pressure case, and then you have to make things work talking to a computer inside of the submarine, Alvin. But it's an extension of existing technology. It's nothing dramatically new.
And from this, you will actually then have a better idea what's going on. What will that tell you if you've discovered that it's, let's say, crystal luminescence some of the other sonoluminescence?
Well, it'll tell you what the spectral character of the light is. It will tell you perhaps where you're going to find the most light, and that there are different vents with different characteristics, both chemically and physically, and so then you might be able to target certain vents as being the ones that are most interesting scientifically. And finally, it may tell you what kinds of uses biological organisms might make of this light.
Yeah, and I guess that's a highly speculative aspect for Cindy. She kind of wonders if there are microorganisms down there that are actually photosynthesizing light.
Well, that's one of the biological consequences, certainly. If there is enough light there, that would be a very interesting question to ask.
Yeah. I guess finally, is there a point from your perspective about this story that you find particularly intriguing or that you are particularly keen to work on?
Well, I am a marine physicist. I build instruments to go in the ocean, and this is a particularly challenging one, so that's one aspect of it. And I think it's a fascinating concept that there might be light at the bottom of the ocean where we wouldn't have expected light, and to understand what that is all about is a really interesting thing.
Yeah, and I guess I don't know if you're the person to ask this, but this might shed light, so to speak, if you excuse the pun, on maybe early forms of life? I mean, aren't there some theories that these kind of conditions might have existed at the dawn of, you know, life on Earth, and that it might shed some insight into our extreme past?
Well, I don't want to touch that one. I'm a biologist.
Well, all right. Okay, good. All right. So anything else then, that I haven't asked you about that you find interesting that you'd like to see in the story?
I think you've covered it pretty well, and particularly if you've talked to Cindy, I'm sure you have a good cross through the whole thing.
Great.
15 years ago, Robin Song sent away for a Ukrainian egg-making kit. She was fascinated by the history behind the art form.
Well, they've been a symbol in the Ukraine of nature's rebirth, and then Christianity came there in 988 AD, and they became part of the Holy Sabbath and the Lenten, the end of the Lenten celebration. They hand them out on the Holy Saturday. They bring them in. They're hidden from view all year as the women work on them in the family, and then they bring them to Holy Saturday, when the food for Easter Sunday feast is brought to the church for the holy water blessing. And then the eggs are revealed and presented to the priest to be blessed. And on Easter Sunday morn, the Lenten fast is broken and the feasting begins. And the girls in the family give their favorite egg to their boyfriend.
By combining traditional geometric Ukrainian designs with wildlife scenes, Song makes eggs that are uniquely her own. She paints eagles, bears, caribou, lynx, and some special requests.
I had an emu egg came my way, and the emu eggs are very dark green, and I got the idea to do a night scene so I could use the background color of the egg. So I did wolves on a snowbank, and I put northern lights in the sky, and I did stars, and I thought, well, put Hale Bopp up there as a memorial.
Song uses wax and dye baths to paint the eggs. First, she blows out the insides. Then she covers everything she wants white with wax, using pencils, brushes, and metal tips. Next, she dips the egg in yellow dye. Then she draws what she wants yellow with wax and dips the egg in orange. Red, blue, and purple are the next color baths.
And if I want green, say, after the yellow bath, I paint on areas like grass blades with blue, which makes it green, and I wax over that.
Song says it takes 6 to 8 hours to make each egg. She uses eggs of all shapes and sizes, from tiny finch eggs to the largest orbs of them all, African ostrich eggs. But many of her pieces come from her pet hen named Jen.
Jen's a little old English bantam, and she lives in the cabin with my Australian shepherds and my cat and I. And she lays eggs sporadically, and I save those, blow them out, and paint on those. She has to come over and watch what I'm doing every once in a while, make sure they're pretty enough.
Although it's detailed and time-consuming work, Song encourages people to decorate their own Easter eggs this way. She says eggs aren't as fragile as people think. In Fairbanks, with help from Johanna Urick at KTNA in Talkeetna, I'm Teresa Bacher.
I just want to let people know that this is...
Tapes rolling. Have at it.
3, 2, 1. No study has conclusively linked the crash of Prince William Sound herring to the Exxon Valdez oil spill, but biologists suspect it as a factor which made the fish susceptible to disease. Now, for the first time since 1993, the population is back at a level where the sacro fishery can resume. Cordova biologist Slim Morstad began overflights this week to begin looking for signs that herring may be ready to spawn.
As the season goes and the fish start maturing and getting close to spawning, you know, they're on the surface and you can see them swimming around, so that's what we look for.
Morstad says it's typically mid-April before the herring fishery gets underway, but that a warm winter should have allowed herring to mature faster and possibly mean an earlier opening. Over 37,000 tons of spawning herring are expected this spring. About 10% of that will be managed for the fishery. Once herring begin to spawn, Morstad says the fishery is scheduled around roe content.
When fish reach a higher roe maturity weight of 11-12%, you should be going, and you just see it change from 7 to 10 to the row weight increases, and that's what you're looking for.
Morstad says gear groups are released to maximize row take in four different spring herring fisheries. The Sacro-Seine is the largest. 3,277 tons of fish will be managed for that fishery's 107 permit holders in what will likely be a 24-hour opening. 24 gillnetters are allotted another 192 tons. There are also pound and wild spawn on kelp spring herring roe fisheries in Prince William Sound. In Valdez, I'm Dan Bross.
About.
When I was 17 and in my teens, I would, like most kids, I didn't think anything could kill me. I drove fast, I wrecked a car, the whole bit. How are you able to communicate? How are you getting through to them? What is it that you're telling them?
I'm just telling them, you know, as a teenager, through my eyes, you know, this can happen. You know, I've been through so many relationships. I myself have been getting tested because I don't know what the results are. I don't want to take after my parents, as my dad would say, you know, don't follow in the same footsteps as I am. But I think what I want to get out is let people know that, you know, I may look normal and all, but you don't know the background of what my life is like, and I've chosen to share that. My mom is really proud of what I'm doing. I can't say the same for my dad. My dad and I don't really talk that much. I think he's ashamed of this because he was the very first one to contract it. As for now, he's slowly coming out with it, explaining it to us. But he's realizing that, you know, I know quite a bit because I've been getting out explaining, and that's the same with my mom. I guess you could say I'm taking after my mom. I've got a big heart, traveling one, share things, and that's mainly what I'm doing.
When people think of AIDS, they often think of this is a gay disease. It only happens to homosexuals, and it can't happen here, especially in my village.
I think that's how they felt the first time we had found out, like in our village, but I don't know, honestly. But, you know, this is a couple that has kids, and, you know, they contracted it, and it happens to anyone. It's not just gay people. I always thought it was from gay people because that's what I was around. I heard, you know, HIV only comes from gay people. But now you look and you see all these parents, some of them are parents, some of them aren't gay, that have contracted HIV. And you get blown apart by that, and that's what happened to me the first time I found out.
What do you want people your age to start thinking about and doing with what you're telling them?
I guess you could say is just listen to what I'm trying to get at, you know. Don't take advantage of putting your life at risk because it can happen. You never know when it will happen if you take advantage of what you're doing to yourself. Sooner or later, it's going to come up.
What's your take on safe sex, premarital sex? What do you tell kids who are your age and thinking about that kind of thing?
The only thing I could say is if you don't have a condom, you don't got nothing. That's my point of view.
What do you mean?
If you want to have safe sex, you choose to use a condom or not. In one of my relationships, I had brought up the condom situation, and my partner had told me, no, you have to bring it up. You're the one that has to bring it to me. And I go, no, you know, this is not just a female thing. You know, the males have to participate in this. And we kind of argued about it, and at that point, we didn't do anything. And that's where the line draws for me. You know, you don't got a condom. You don't got nothing, in my point of view. And it's your decision, basically, but you're putting your life at risk. I know condoms aren't really 100%, you know, protective and all, but that's the only way you could choose to use a condom, or abstinence is the best way.
in a small community, there's a lot of peer pressure and other things that are going on about, let's not really talk about this.
Mm-hmm.
How do you respond? How do you get that out?
For my village, Nanwalek, I had this fear, you know, my family's going to get kicked out of the village, you know, because their parents are contracted with this virus. But it took the whole village to probably bring up something, you know, these are family members. We are going to accept them as who they are. We're not going to just leave them and throw them aside, you know, they're people, they're family. And they've accepted it for the last few years, and I'm really grateful. And I've lived in the village for many years. You can say 16 years because I moved to Homer for a year, my 10th grade year. But they have accepted the way of life. I mean, that's something I'd like to point out. You know, they don't give up on people. They help and support them.
So when somebody comes into a village, somebody comes home, they've got HIV to a village that they're from, but nobody's ever had HIV in that village, how should people respond?
Supporting is the best way. Support, showing you will always be there for them, no matter what, you know. Don't push them aside like they're nothing. These people have a really bad illness that cannot be cured. You have to choose. Basically, it's your decision on what you want to do. All I can say is if you push them aside, that's a lot of ignorance against you. You know, you're being really childish about it. But I would say you need to give a lot of support, love, and caring, and let them know you will always be there no matter what happens.
Well, a good example of this is probably a company that was formed in Stamford, Connecticut in October of 1897. It was called the Connecticut and Alaska Mining and Trading Association. And this was a company which was formed by six businessmen. Yankee traders, really interesting characters. They were all very much go-getters in the capitalistic sense of the word. And they decided to form a joint stock company of 30 individuals, pool their resources, and make a trip up to Alaska and the Copper River. And to sell this plan, these six businessmen got together, and their secretary, a man by the name of King, wrote a prospectus that was to be distributed to prospective stockholders. And it's really interesting to read this prospectus and read Charles Margeson's book called Gold Seekers in Alaska to see the difference between what his expectations were when he started on this expedition and what he actually encountered when he came to Valdez, crossed the glacier, went into the Copper Valley, and of course found no gold. But anyway, I'd like to read you a little bit of this prospectus that was put together by these Easterners, and it certainly shows the very unrealistic expectations of these people, but the extreme enterprising spirit that motivated the whole gold rush. King writes, "We propose to start for the mouth of the Copper River, leaving Seattle about February 1st. We will sail up the river as far as the rapids, which are about 100 miles, really 35 miles, up from the mouth. We shall then launch the steam launch, load it with provisions for a week's trip, rope, blocks, arms, ammunition, the boring machine, and 10 men, and start up through the rapids. If the boat will not make any headway against the rapids, we will send some of the men up the bank till they get up above the rapids. Then they can make fast one end of the rope, which they will take with them to a tree or spur of rock, and tie the other end to a log and throw it in the river, where the swift current will carry it down
to the waiting men in the launch, who will speedily haul themselves up through the rapids. Once over them, we have 200 miles of good navigable river. We will steam right ahead till we find the miners who have gone in there ahead of us, and if they have found gold in good paying quantities, we will locate near them and stake out claims, and leave 5 or 6 men there, and the rest will return down the river to the schooner. The men on the schooner, in the meantime, will have built a good-sized barge with lumber, which we will bring with us from Seattle, and have it loaded with provisions, tools, sawmill, and the whole outfit on her. If we cannot tow it up to the claims with the whole outfit on her, we will make it in 2 or more trips. If we do not find any parties up there, we will steam slowly up the river, prospecting as we go with our boring machine on every creek and gulch we see on both sides of the river. If we find gold in large quantities, we intend to stake out a town site, build a blockhouse to live in, put up our sawmill, establish a store or trading station, dig out some gold, and send it down the river by the crew of the schooner, and start them back to Seattle. Show the gold and make a hurrah, boom the location, load the schooner with provisions and a number of men to work in the mines. Crowds of prospectors will rush in. The king ends his statement in the following manner. The officers of this association are competent mechanics and receive no salary for their services. Everyone a hustler.
Do you think this was this like a sell proposal, or do they really believe? Were they this hopeful?
No, I think they really believed it. It was just based on total ignorance of the actual situation. When they got up here, of course, they found that the Copper River wasn't navigable, and they came to the head of Port Valdez. What's kind of interesting is that some of their goals they did accomplish. They didn't find any gold, but they did set up a store in Valdez, and they did make quite a bit of money actually selling lumber and other items to the gold rushers. One of the things they brought with them was a blacksmith smithy and a couple of blacksmiths, and when people were going up onto the glacier and found out that they needed crampons, this blacksmith actually manufactured out of some of the sheet metal they had brought some crampons and sold them at a really good profit to the gold rushers. In fact, this group, actually when they arrived on the boat, took their straw mattresses that they had slept on in the boat and sold those to prospectors going across the glacier. These guys are really enterprising. But probably the most interesting thing, again, that sort of emphasizes this theme, is the steam sled that they brought with them. These guys, far off in Connecticut, had designed and built probably the first snow machine. They had taken a couple of bobsleds and put them together in a flexible manner, constructed a huge metal roller with spikes on it in the front, and then put a small steam engine on the back. And this thing was supposed to roll along and carry their goods, I guess, up the Copper River or over the glacier.
Must have been extraordinarily heavy, though.
Oh, it was very heavy. They had an awful time loading it on the schooner and offloading it in Valdez. They almost lost it, actually, unloading it on the ice when the ice started to break up. And the interesting thing is what happened when they got here, and again, it sort of underscores this disparity between expectations and realities. Addison Powell describes the advent of the steam sled on the beach at Valdez. He writes, "Connecticut furnished a visionary company made up of persons who were distinguished from others by having brought a steam sled. All they wanted was to have the right direction pointed out to them, and he would steam over the glacier, ascend the Copper River, and stampede Indians, white men, and every other thing encountered. Strangers, after looking at the ponderous affair, retired to a safe distance with an expression of misgiving. When the machine was steamed up and properly directed, the owners looked at each other and disappointedly, for it failed to move. They applied the full limit of steam, and it stood still some more. While the joke began to settle on the men from Connecticut, the citizens should preserve that steam sled from vandalism as an evidence of the rushers of 1898. It had the record of being the first automobile in Alaska and was never guilty of exceeding the speed limit."
So it never moved. It just sort of
never moved. It probably rotted on the beach here. We think we have a photograph somebody leaning against a piece of equipment that's probably the old steam sled.